My name is Dick Lukey, and we will be talking in this hour about recovering work for community. Now we can talk about anything we want, right? Well, we have talked about the church as public, and kind of stories the communities have to form them, just as the church has its stories and the relationship between the two and how church people and citizens go back and forth. And we've talked about the importance of community and congregation for the people we have now labeled and served in certain ways. Get that connection going again. And today we want to talk about work and the importance of community for that. It's not the only thing to be said about work, but I would venture that it's kind of a missing thing that needs saying. Sigmund Freud, people as different as Sigmund Freud and John Paul II, have said that work is a major question of the 20th century. Freud said the problem is how to work and to love. I put those together, whatever he meant. John Paul says that work, the question of work, is key to the entire societal question. And I think we all have a kind of problem with this, do we not? There's great ambiguity about work. Carl Sandburg has a wonderful poem about muckers in Chicago. Muckers were the guys who dug in that yellow clay to stick in gas mains in Chicago. And he says here, of the 20 looking on, 10 murmur, "Oh, it's a hell of a job." 10 others, "Jesus, I wish I had the job." And it's a little religious language there, you understand, but it's kind of fervor. I think we all have this. When we don't have a job, it's the one thing in the world we want. As soon as we get it, we're counting the hours till Friday, right? To be without a job is not just economic, it's personal. We're distraught, we're destroyed. But once we get it, we start groaning and moaning and planning our vacation. It is kind of necessary, and it's ambiguous also in the scriptures. Work is both blessed. It is blessed. Work is not a curse. It is blessed before the fall, and it's cursed. It is both vanity, like everything else under the sun, and it is cooperation with the Creator. It's a groaning, moaning thing in this world. On the other hand, you may also participate in the groaning of the creation and have the Spirit assure you that you belong to God's own purpose of bringing a new kind of world to pass. So that the ambiguity is there. And I venture that some of the differences within the streams of Christendom come out partly just by coming down on different sides of the ambiguity. There's a kind of standard distinction between, say, Roman Catholic and Protestant attitudes toward work, especially in Europe. And it could be that we're each trying to spoil the ambiguity a little bit, and doing so in somewhat different ways. Anyway, we do have a problematic area here all the time, and it's especially problematic these days. And we'll want to say in a minute what we see there that makes us want to talk about it. But anyway, that is to be our topic. And not just personal, but work in community. And then I think we want to look a little bit at public policies, which have something to do with whether or not work gets put together with communities. Some of our lifetimes, a great shift took place with respect to public policy and work. Since Woodrow Wilson, especially, remember, who said the government could be put to work on behalf of the casualties of industrial civilization, society must not destroy its own constituent parts. Then came Franklin Roosevelt's Four Freedoms, and even the UN declarations on the economic rights as well as civil and political rights, which had been the American thing. There's been a kind of new government initiative about work, although recently there's been kind of a reaction to that, either because that didn't work or it seemed to go too far or something, so that now, at least in the last 8 years, we've had a retrenchment of that. John Galbraith says that the current doctrine is that the poor people don't work because they get too much money, and the rich people don't work because they don't have enough money, something like that. Policies is retrenching, and that's in the air too. So that should be part of our discussion as well. And I suggest that we go at it once again with Walter Altman's scheme. What do we see? How do we judge that? Knowing that you can come back. Once you've used your biblical insights to judge a thing, you may go back and look for some facts you haven't been looking for before. And then what shall we do? Backwards and forwards. In fact, as he's told us, life is a matter of action and reflection, not just reflection on the way to actions. So, let's just do this together. What do we see with respect to the world of work that makes it problematic for us? And even more problematic, perhaps, for faith when we get to looking at it in that way? Well, let's tick off some obvious things. Unemployment, right? Unemployment became a word in the 1890s. It wasn't even a word before that. I mean, there'd always been some work-shy people and work-less people. But it's only, I think, in a kind of late, in an industrial society, where decision somewhere can put all a whole lot of people out of work, whether they want to or not. It becomes unemployment in that sense. And that's a worry to us. At the moment, we're announcing something like 7%, which doesn't look so bad. Richard Nixon once said that should count as full employment. But it's misleading, that national statistic. There are places where it's 50% of the young people are not working now and perhaps will never work. And it's kind of strange. And in spite of some good intentions, we can't break that one loose. When you come to judging that, people give a lot of different reasons. Some even like to say it's not unemployment really, it's sort of a new unemployment that's not serious because it's women. When a lot of women and young people enter the labor force, the number of people looking for jobs goes up and so unemployment goes up. Don't worry until you start looking at who it is that's... And these women are not their heads of households in many cases and need the second. So that's how you move back and forth between seeing and judging. But at least let's admit that unemployment is one of the things that makes this a problem for us. And what else do we see?
Underemployment.
Yeah. That 7% is misleading, right? A lot of people at work, if you work a couple hours a week, you count as employed.
And because of the salary range on the low end of the spectrum, even employed doesn't mean you're out of the poverty.
That's right.
Cycle. You can work very hard.
Yeah. Also, a lot of people quit looking for jobs and they don't affect the employment figure at all. You have to be looking to be in the labor force. So these, you're suggesting there are ways to interpret these statistics that they're not serious or they're very serious. And that's when it gets interesting, when you start looking at actual people behind the numbers. The numbers are used simply to turn on and off government fiscal and monetary policy. But what we've just now said is that what works nationally may not be true at all here or there. It's just not. What's true about everybody isn't true about anybody or any particular group. Another thing to look at least in my town, and I bet in many of yours, you have newly shuttered communities. Quite apart from the total employment, here was it used to be a working community. For generations it was a working community. Now the factories are closed and the houses are shut. But somehow it went somewhere else. We want to talk about how to judge that later, but that's worrisome. I mean, actual communities. One time we said Chrysler was too important to let go. Can you let whole communities go? I mean, you got a lot of public investment in there, the sewers and the schools and this and that. But whole communities, even in a relatively, when you got employment going in the economy, communities can disappear or become real casualties. It is a casualty when an auto worker or a steel worker who's been making $19 an hour is now asked to go to work on a computer for $5. I mean, it's not only the skills are strange, but the life is disrupted.
The tragedy is generational, too, because no longer can young people look at the jobs their father had and expect to live in a community in the Midwest or the East and say, well, I don't have to worry because I'll take this job and I see my dad bring it home a nice paycheck every week. And
he'll get me in a union.
Right, the union, the whole works. Well, those jobs are no longer there.
And the deals we're making with the union don't include our kids anymore. So the measures we had to ameliorate, right, the situation are not so obviously there. That does help us see a problem that we'd like to look at with faithful eyes in a moment. Walter Altman has been talking about competition between third world workers and the workers here. Very strange. You know, that you should be able to play off Brazilians against people in Gary, Indiana. And thereby reduce rewards on both ends. How do you, I mean, it's problematic. We're not saying what the problem is yet, but it's something worrisome there. Is it only in the among the poor, this problem?
I think among those of us who are middle class or upper class, at least in my area, I think there's another problem, that's overemployment. And by that I mean sort of being asked to make work your idol.
Interesting phrase. We have unemployment, underemployment, and overemployment. We got a pretty good sheaf of terms here now. That's right. And also maybe kinds of employment. Those of us who do work in services these days, overwhelmingly. It's gone from 90-10 production and services, I'm not clarifying what's meant on both sides, but let me do it, to a kind of 65-35 in the 20s. It's almost automatic. 50-50 at 1950, and now it's just turned around. 35 production, 65 services, and Daniel Bell says after the turn of the century it should go to 90-10 the other way around, except you can't imagine such a society. And some other times when we've sat together here, we have also questioned that vast expansion of services. It's nice that a lot of people have jobs that wouldn't otherwise be working. A friend of mine came back from the University of Michigan, where he addressed some graduates there and was surprised to find that 17 graduates were going to be grief therapists. College graduates going out to be grief therapists. It's nice they have jobs, but I think we've also seen that tends to dissolve communities, or how that's really done. We talked about the medical model last evening. We shouldn't be talking about it. There is a kind of medical model abroad that whatever trouble you have, somebody will, for a fee, stick something in you or up you or down you that will make it better. And there's been more and more jobs along that line. If you get very cynical, you can talk about how a whole community of middle-class service personnel can live off of, say, a community or two of poor folks. Our question, though, is what happens to the community when this is the case? When I no longer talk to my neighbors, or even my druggist, but take my green card straight to the public hospital. Or wait, which is the case may be. But what about any other middle-class problems? I've got one to tell you about. The Wall Street Journal did an article of a village, Morton Grove in Chicago. There's a whole series, four or five articles, on the changes of Morton Grove in that time was 10 years. Some obvious things had changed. At one time, there were no fast foods places, now there were 17 or something like that, and the people's eating habits had changed. They were all really bringing in fish and chips and McDonald's for supper. School habits had changed. Parents were dropping off children at 6 in the morning or 6:30. Youngsters had to be taken care of till school started. If they got sick, there was nobody at home. They had to be put in a little clinic. After school, the older ones had, you know, open house up and down the block, where all of us remember getting our real education. Access to the liquor cabinet and this and that, and they were actually ripping things off in one house and stashing them. This is Morton Grove, Illinois, stashing them in the next house. So they had to put out a new police unit to kind of watch the young in the afternoon. Parents Teachers Association had diminished from 3 such associations, each of which had above 100 parents attending meetings, to 1 association, which had 50 people coming. And other changes, down to one I particularly remember, that now when somebody gets married, they think they should invite a neighbor, but they don't know the neighbor's name, though that was partly why they live in Morton Grove, because you're friendly, know everyone. And one of the last items was that, well, the reason, of course, this is happening is that now you have families with two or three people in the labor force. That's what we're really talking about. That's been the change. And that has had to take place because housing prices doubled or tripled. You send another person to the labor force to be able to afford the same house you lived in before, or one like it, or maybe an upgraded one. And then all of these other things kind of fall out. We're talking a little bit about the organization of work vis-a-vis family or community, and what one mother said is that it's very nice. It has, in fact, added 25% or something like that to families' disposable income. Very nice because at Christmas you can go to Lauderdale Hilton and be with the family. Excuse me.
I just thought of something else along those same lines you mentioned as far as societal changes. And you take a look at California, I'm sure this is true all over the United States, as we have more leisure time, especially among the upper middle class people, there creates a need for so-called tourism. In fact, many communities have taken over tourism, which in turn needs a different type of labor force, many of which predicated on low wages, whether they're housemaids or cleaners or what have you. A second example might be, recently a national magazine had a feature article about this new gambling mecca in Nevada, outside 30 or 40 miles from Las Vegas, and which has created a huge town where people come in by busload, plane, and what have you. But the people that work there live across the river in Arizona, and it has really created a whole bag full of social problems as far as low income, and then the kids are constantly gone because both parents are working across the river in gambling areas. And so there's social changes, societal changes in work has created a number of problems too that I think we need to take a look at.
I think we've begun to say, even though we're just naming some things that we're looking at, seeing things, that one of the problems is that work is not so obviously sustaining social units as before, right? The very way work is organized tends to make it tough for families and makes, we're going to lose a lot of employment unless communities are shattered. That's a bad way to say it, but I mean a kind of way of servicing each other so that what we mean by community has tended to raises our question then, work and community or recovering of work for community. We want to talk about judging that. Moving here. And here, remember, if we do it as a community, let's pretend we're a congregation or Morton Grove or something like that. Community. How do you go at it? And here we say you have to come at it out of your own sort of symbols or your own tradition. We read an ancient text to improve our eyesight in the present, even though it didn't address the present. Or we know what our texts tell us when we're able to say what they would say in a situation they did not directly address. See if we can do that. Now here I have a story to tell. In the late 60s, it fell to me to conduct little consultations in neighborhoods, 25 neighborhoods around the city, consultations on the question of work. And those were the days when there was great agitation for the Humphrey Hawkins bill for full employment. And I would sometimes get to that point, we'd be around the table talking like this. And down at the opposite end of the table on one occasion was a Baptist minister, quite scholarly fellow. And he just sort of began lobbing in some scripture. He did what Martin Buber said we all should do. When you tell a Bible story, say we. So I was talking about this new proposed bill for full employment, which incidentally was passed in 78 and then laid to rest with Hubert Humphrey in the years that followed. Anyway, this pastor sat there at the end of the table with his arms crossed like this, pretty big fellow, and he said, when we was in Egypt, he said, when we was in Egypt, he said, we had full employment. He said, everybody had a job. But we didn't call that work. We could make bricks, but we couldn't make a house for ourselves. We didn't have anything to say about how we worked or why we worked. Even if the Pharaoh had sent somebody every hour on the hour, he said, with Kool-Aid, we still wouldn't call that work. Not good work. There was nothing to do but to flee the flesh pots of Egypt. And he goes on. When we was in the wilderness, he said, there was no work to be found. But we learned to live from day to day. And we lived by a promise. The promise was the land. everyone would have a fig tree, a place to stand and be free and receive the sojourner and the needy. Even when we came to the land, he said, we had to fight for it. He said, I tell you, if we didn't fight for it, we'd never get it, and the Lord would punish us besides. That's how he put it. And then he said, and even when we gained the land, we could always lose it again. We could lose the land in two ways. The Philistines could come and steal our sheep, or the Assyrians could burn our crops and carry off our sons. Or, he said, Solomon. King Solomon could send one of his managers. We always knew when the man stood there with a clipboard that when he was through, we wouldn't have something that we had before. He could have gone on, and no doubt often does. The Leviticus, yeah. Oh yeah, say amen. The laws which this people, let's not do the Old Testament people, and the customs, the understandings that grew up in that community, in Torah, were quite strikingly different because of the experience of the Exodus and the wilderness and Sinai. They did talk about dealing your bread to the hungry and taking the homeless into your home, which was the understanding. But above all, about making sure that the poor person got a tool or a skill. Maimonides says this very wonderful, to anticipate poverty by putting something in the hands of the poor person to work with, the old fishing pole deal. But it went on. You were not to mow your fields to the edge or twice. You were not, get this, Altman, you were not to charge interest on loans because that was a dispossessing factor. This very moment, I think the new Lutheran boards are disowning the agreement about pension fund. Interest is higher elsewhere than in investment, the kind of things the folks have asked for. Anyway, not to charge interest. And then every seventh year, every Sabbath year, the land was to lie fallow so that those who were indentured, working off in debt, you know, would have a chance to work the land for themselves and get a foothold again. And then there's a famous provision that every seventh Sabbath, the Jubilee year, land would return to original tribes and families. Now, the question always asks, you know, but did they ever really do it? And when Mr. Yoder comes next week, he will...
John,
I think he's coming. He doesn't kid around about this. No. He thinks that's just part of the biblical wisdom. A Roman Catholic scholar named North, Robert North, thinks that the Jubilee, if it wasn't celebrated nationwide, you know, with the blowing of the horn, might have been written into individual contracts. That's something like the Rockefeller buildings. The city owns, the family owns it till 1992 or something, and then that it might have been in individual contracts. Incidentally, that ram's horn, Norman Gutwald points out that the same word is used as the horn that was blown around Jericho, a big city built with slave labor when all the walls came down. Anyway, these provisions come out of the life and experience of the Exodus and the wilderness, and these provisions now that work shall not be displaced. Not that everybody should have a job simply. Our preacher and the scripture has a, I think, prefers the word work to job, as Hannah Arendt says. And the Greeks, you distinguish between job and work. Work has dimensions. And when Israel gets down around to writing Genesis, which it, you know, it comes after the Exodus, then when they talk about work, you get work not as just putting some food in your mouth, whether by salary or slavery or any other way, but it has to do with relationships to the earth, to woman, to others, as the very embodiment of your relationship to God. Work is the way in which you activate and express and clarify your faith. It's how it comes to function. So it would not be a little thing if that's not possible for folks. Would not be a little thing from point of view of faith. All right. In the New Testament, you know, New Testament's excited little document. It's done not over many years, but just like one little century or less. And so you don't get a lot about work, but some interesting things. Sometimes the disciples are told to leave their work. Sometimes they are told to work, but not for a living. It would be like the birds of the air that go about laying their eggs, building their nests, rearing their young, but taking their food on the wing as they find it. And it can also say, those who don't work, neither should they eat. Repeating Proverbs, 1 Thessalonians. And we can be sure that all of those are good and right things to be said in different circumstances, but I don't know how far it really gets us. In the early years after the New Testament, biblical peoples took sharp exception to the leisure culture in Rome and Greece, in accordance with which manual labor was assigned to slaves, and us free folk went into the marketplace and talked about our common life. Kind of this division between physical and civic work, and between the slave and the free. Christians took, as did the Jews, took exception to that, insisting that all should both work and be free. There were disciplines even about what kind of work you could take. The fathers, the monastics east and west, proscribed or made rules against a kind of commerce in which you had your thumb on the scale and you used false weights in order to succeed. You'd have to stay out of commerce if that's what was required. They told people they couldn't go into painting if it meant painting idols. They were really kind of serious about some things you couldn't. Not just everybody must work, but some things you better not do. And Augustine was angry, I mean, really serious about work in the stadium. He took issue with the notion of catharsis, which is, you know, the classical understanding. What the arts do to you, they purge you of your pity and your fear by seeing this sad spectacle on the stage. He said, that's probably what's happening in the stadium. People go there only to grieve, not to relieve. And they let off much needed steam. In other words, there was a kind of, we're now talking not just about whether everybody should have a job, but some disciplines about what that work should be. And Peter Brown and others who refer to excavations of early monastic communities see that these were not meant to be, how to say, a retreat from the world or a retreat from one another. The way they're laid out and so on indicates that these were communities for the sake of communication and for the sake of developing the kind of work that makes that possible and getting rid of things that make it impossible. So that work and community was on this reading, a focus of the biblical peoples in the ancient world. And of course, and in the Didache, the early Christian teaching, it was insisted that all should do manual labor, not excluding the clergy. And Augustine had to write a dissertation, and I think as late as the 13th century, Aquinas had to write a dissertation defending certain monks who were spending all their time grinding at books as though that counted as work. Last night we were talking about whether this nice Holden village where everybody has work, whether teachers count. Well, in view of at least that. In fact, this brotherhood or sisterhood of labor was so strong that some slaves could become popes, at least two, and one bishop could sell himself into slavery to purchase the freedom of a widow's son. It was a kind of a countercultural understanding of work that grew out of a kind of biblical seeing and therefore a new judging in the situation in which we live. Benedict and the Benedictine order actually form a rule every day, time for labor, time for sacred reading, time for contemplation. Every day. And this provides a kind of basis for the monastic ideal, which is a kind of ideal for all the Middle Ages. I mean, even if you weren't religious in that sense, you nonetheless said that's what the city should be, like that, both prayer and work, everybody pray, and we pay our respects to that by coming and joining the monks in the field or in the shops. Until a different kind of wind gets blowing in northern Italy in the Hanseatic League, and something else needs to be said. Max Weber's, which talks about how the divines, the clergy, the churches were worried about the developing industrial economy. They thought that work looked too much like Egypt on the assembly line, even made that comparison. Answer always was, well, it's just temporary, pretty soon we'll own our own. But not everybody did. About the turn of the century, the question became a little more venal. The question was not just is it right, but can it continue? They were just worried whether, you know, you could use all these products. And international markets were sought for the first time. But that's all before 80 other nations became industrial producers. Until the last response that Daniel Rogers talks about, of course, is, well, if we don't, somebody else will. You have to compete and stay in there. Otherwise, it's total loss. You can't get that kind of notion that it's rolling along, and you better get on the bandwagon and go at all possible somewhere near the front. So, all this by way of saying that in every age, the congregations, the church, has clarified and activated its faith with respect to the world of work, but there's this little question whether we've really come to terms with all that's going on in the world of work today. It's something to talk about. Okay? All right. Now, I think maybe we should just say a little bit about responses along the way that were more official on the part of the church. In the 1890s, the very time when unemployment became a word for the first time, you get De Rerum Novarum of Leo XIII, great social statement on the dignity of the worker and the warning against development of work that destroys communities. 40 years later, you get Quadragesimo Anno, marvelous social statement, which repeats these themes again, including subsidiarity. Nothing should be done at a higher level that can be done at a lower level. Pluralism, that we should be interested in more ways of doing things, and a refusal to go either for communism or capitalism. That still marks John Paul II's Laborum Exercens, his dissertation on labor, in which he says it's a major question of our time. So the church has responded, has in some cases supported the labor movement, which tried to keep a little countervailing force in there so that what Altman described wouldn't happen all over, and did achieve gains here. The question is whether it's able to do so now with respect to the next generation, which is already found at that point. Church has also marched with the civil rights movement to get people in who are out, though at this moment, in 50 American cities, there's more massive segregation than there was at that time, according to William Julius Wilson's data. And we have, I think, worked hard at remedial services, though we have been brought in our own discussions here to wonder whether that's kind of a sort of a distorted development, or at least one that doesn't really create communities. We still have the problem of putting work and community back together. Something like that might be the discourse by which we do our judging. And then the question is, what do we do? What is to be done? Any ideas? Let's ask a little bit about the mechanisms by which this has all come to pass. the modern city and the modern communities we're talking about, including former working communities, were brought about by great migrations, the great movement from the land to the city. Why? Well, because new techniques, new machinery, and new capital found better ways to work the land. Farm workers have reduced from 70% to 7% or something like that of the labor force needed to produce, you know, the food and fiber that we need. So they came to the city. Other immigrants came from Europe, infused with the idea of opening a shop of their own. What happened in the city? Same thing, especially in times of war, this usually happens. Little shops merge and become big shops. They not only merge, but they move. If labor's cheaper somewhere else, like in neighboring states, Sunbelt, overseas, labor is running to catch up at every step right down to the water's edge. Not just labor, but money moves. Some statistics show that the factories move two times as fast as the labor force. They're running to catch up. Money moves to where, I guess the word we want to talk about in a minute is productivity, right? Or productivity where you get the biggest product per buck. It is not terribly concerned about the communities that are left behind high and dry. That does seem more and more to be kind of how we'd like to state the problem, work and community. That's been lost. And the whole thing begins to look a little bit, how should we say, natural. Machinery, capital, gold, labor's run, money runs, investment simply goes to where? Simply goes to where you get the fastest, maybe short-term, I mean, it's computer-driven investments. Our only point at the moment, and maybe that's even wise from some perspectives, but it doesn't have community in mind or other kind of costs that then emerge. And the picture that emerges in my mind is something very natural taking place. It's like machinery and money and workers are just sort of rolling down the mountain to the sea. Finally, some kind of natural, the computers could do it, or nature could do it. In Chicago, there's a free street theater that likes to do things in the streets. And they like to set up on Michigan Avenue under the big towers. And they have an opening song that begins, "This is not the forest primeval, this is the forest that Jack built." By way of trying to say, isn't there some initiative about all this? Aren't we more the natural, or something like that? What would we do if we thought about it? Now maybe we're oversimplifying here, and of course we've always had the public arena in which to take care of the casualties and all that. But it's a good question whether even public policies can do much about community unless people at that level are doing it. And so, what is to be done?
I've got an example of community, and a good example would be in San Francisco, in the ethnic community of the North Beach or Broadway area, which is primarily an Italian district, where the people in the community have bonded together and they say, we need to support ourselves. And they listed, they're working with real estate people and commercial interests, and they're saying, these are the types of businesses we want in our community, and these are the type we don't want. We don't want more yogurt shops. We don't want more of these, all these kind of stores and convenience things that bring in the tourism trade. We want bakeries. We want retail markets, let's say. The services that a community needs to survive. And I think it's an interesting thing. There was a list of, in fact, the San Francisco paper had a list of the businesses that they want and the businesses that they don't want. And these lists have been given to the real estate people, and they have a community action program for that.
This was a community council of some kind?
Sure, honestly.
Oh, let's hang on to that. Yeah. We're going to have to talk, you know, how else?
Shoemakers, right. They want these
shoemakers
to come back into their area.
Jane Addams has a kind of... Who wrote Cities and the Wealth, Jane Jacobs, I'm so sorry, Jane Jacobs. And it's kind of a wonderful book called Cities and the Wealth of Nations, in which she says the real action in economic development is in the cities. That's where it takes, that doesn't take place in Washington. And that national statistics tend to miss where the action is. I mean, where people are really developing those little shops, and little shops are developing other little shops, you know, to supply them and so on, and to sell their products. That's where the action is in the cities, but it's not always revealed by ordinary macro statistics that go on. And she goes on to say that what the mechanism by which cities work, or by which development starts taking place is, first of all, replacing imports. If the kind of things you've been buying from out there can become the kind of things you produce, then the money stops. In one of the strategies we're going to point to is, I hope, would be even trying to do that with welfare money. It is not as though no money goes through poor communities. In the community just south where I live, we investigated what kind of monies were going through it in all sorts of transfer payments. I mean, welfare and Social Security and Medicare and so on. And it was $60 million a year. In 2 years, $120 million, and we had just made a list of what it would take to turn that community around. It was $120 million. It's not as though the money is nowhere around, but it is as though it's in and out, and how to get some catcher's mitts and get it going around gets to be the... And that means work and community. And the sort of thing you have just mentioned, let me put it this way, not enough to do one thing. Open an employment office will not. Even if three people get a job in a suburb, you're not going to change your community at all. Very much. Or get rid of a high school principal, or get a housing project. So all nice things, and we've done it for a long time, but they don't turn communities around. For that, we need something more like what we just heard. A financial kind of mechanism. How do you get money that has been running out to come back? We should talk about how to do that. Reinvestment. And let's tag that word. I think it's a religious word, isn't it? Let's do this first, then we'll come back there. And investment and a planning council on what kind of development do we want. An improvement of the social structure, families and so on, and their commitment to purchase. Churches, too, on purchasing. A decisional capacity. We have to be able to decide things about this neighborhood or this community. And I guess we need some kind of cultural goals and stories and stuff to make us feel together. It's a big job, but that would enable you to develop a kind of local economy, if you like, not neglecting a regional economy, but a local economy is very key for those second jobs. I don't want to be overly macho, but very much mothers sometimes appreciate this, and youth, local jobs as well as regional jobs, that make community possible. And now let's go back to that question of investment, reinvestment, which I think the church is struggling with. It has, you know, we have great pools of money in this world and investment in pension funds and places like that. What is it doing? Is some computer sending it to Korea or who knows where, building high rises? Or is it doing something more intentional? Are we only responsible for our charity or are we also responsible for our big money?
Well, there is that question being tossed around, being looked at. Ed Crane, I'm trying to remember, he's with corporate responsibility, okay, within the church and society. And one of the things that he is raising questions around is how is the church a responsible entity within the community that it is, you know, that it finds itself in Chicago as the headquarters. In each one of the synods, where those synod offices are, how are we responsible for the way we purchase and the things that we, how we affect that community in which we find ourselves.
You were telling us last night about your purchases.
Oh, yeah.
Not a little thing, or what a congregation can do just with respect to getting the conversation started, we just said, in a community. It's a place to talk, where you do talk about the quality of your life. It also does buy a lot of things. Sometimes from dismal publication houses, I mean, very slick things that we don't have. It has resources, space, I mean, there are old gyms and old kitchens in the city, at least, mm-hmm. that are serving it to become bakeries and stuff for youth enterprise. So that we do want to talk about the role of the church in all this, but let's stick with that word investment just a minute and let me play with it insofar as far enough to remind you that the church has long talked about investiture or investment. What does investment mean? What it means for us in our sort of churchly memory is that we dress something up in order to pay attention to it, in order to say, this is what we're going to seek. This is our direct, we invest something with our interest. It's not what comes naturally, it's what comes intentionally. To divest something would mean we're going to look over here now. So investiture has to do not with looking where there has been the fastest little return in the past, it has to do with what kind of future do we want, what kind of a community do we want in the future. Investment then becomes a kind of a little human decision in it, not just what comes naturally. This is the house that Jack built. So that I would suggest that congregations have something special to say about investiture. It has to do with what they want for the future. Prudence. Isn't there a prudent man principle on investment? I always hear that. Prudence means we have to go where there's the biggest return. No. Prudence means you have to go where your kind of future can be assisted. Prudence means thinking for the future, right? Dressing the credit has something to do with credo? Mr. Altman talks about the open veins of Latin America. Well, investment really, if you want to see open veins, look at a disinvested community. The blood just runs out. That's lifeblood too. You know, there's no circulation. Runs out. How to stanch the flow and get some circulation going, that takes prudence, deliberate investment. And the church has an intention about that, I mean to say. First of all, with respect to its own monies, and then with respect to developing this kind of understanding. You don't, in the end, save a lot of money if you invest in a automatically returning industry of some kind and then have to pick up all the unemployed over here and the social costs, etc., etc. So investment would be one strategy. Very serious. And I think it's under contention at this moment in the church. Reinvestment in disinvested places. And that's done partly by groups. The community I mentioned before has a bank now that's very committed to investing in their own community. It was a bank that was ready to run. It was purchased by folk using some church monies, I might say. Its development monies to this day come largely from religious orders. And it is a way of putting a foot down in that community and turning things around. Very famous South Shore Bank, I'm sure you know the story. So that gets to be an instrument for work and community, right? Housing and enterprises. Attached to it, it's a one bank holding company, has to be a planning or development group. In this case, at least it's attached to a bank, whether that's a good idea or not, I don't know what it is at this moment. And it has a housing section and a neighborhood institute that talks about general development. But in any case, it's a strategy for reinvestment, for stanching the flow and getting the circulation going. Think of others. Congregation or a community wishing now to reclaim work for community, what might be some strategies? Anybody up to something that we should know about?
In some ways, recovering work for community is almost putting the cart before the horse, because in order to reclaim work for community, you have to have a community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole thing about the balance between manual labor, service. I mean, if any of us try to do that in our own lives, it's impossible given the structures of work around us today. It's going to take a community enabling those structures and saying, okay, oh, let's start by providing job opportunities where it makes that possible. But all the jobs out in the world right now are things that go against the idea of community.
Mm-hmm.
such as like main community, get work to get community.
Yeah, well, but I like the way you just said it, and you have it, it's in sequence. I mean, doing something together, it does help to create community, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Granted, you have to have a community first. We did talk about that problem. Communities are under great stress, all the centrifugal forces there are. Nonetheless, communication about a common problem is about the... Mm-hmm. And then all the stuff we said about symbol, learning to make your own judgment out of your own history and take some common action. I can think of a congregation that had a pantry for unemployed and formed a little unemployment union, so that when they came for their groceries, they stayed for some training. And they got themselves ready to do a couple of little things and cut some contracts with the city to be a supplier. We have a city that formerly purchased 60% of its stuff outside and 40% inside the city of a $400 million purchasing budget. It's now changed around to 60-40, and some of that enables community enterprise. We become supplier. Or even simpler, a kind of common advocacy among communities that the city in its development activities should seek as first source of employment, people that live in the city. The first source, use the people you're training. If that doesn't work, look elsewhere if they're not competent or something, but at least that kind of first source procedure. You're starting to use what's at hand, even though they look like first growths, not all the development you really want. But such strategies are important. More specifically within the church, and this is a kind of feeble one, maybe, but it's related to, and maybe job related rather than development related, but in our town, Lutheran churches, city and suburban, have formed a little coalition to work with their own young people in the city. They say that they're ours, and so that they, you know, work with them through the year and lead them around in business establishments, and sometimes it means jobs for them, but they also run some training enterprise. A bakery and a church kitchen and liturgical stitching for the parishes. In this case, it's a little different than just jobs, though, because you have a community behind these young people who will stay with them not through one job, but through two or three. And there have been one or two kind of spectacular results, but that's a simple one. I think coming to Holden one of these days is Mary Nelson. Now there is a parish who, which has started to develop a string of things, not just an employment office, or its own job training program, placement program, or its own school, but its own recycling enterprise, its own housing enterprise. It's worked with Habitat, it's worked with Jimmy Carter, comes and bangs on the housing there, has worked with the Enterprise Fund, Jim Rouse's fund, funds from all over, cut a deal with the local banks since they wanted to move a branch bank on the west side and be another vacuum cleaner for the funds of the people. It's going to get sent somewhere else. That no, there will be $100 million available for new enterprises in the neighborhood. Moving toward a policy of linked development, whatever you do down here should pay off out here in some way or another. The jobs or some other kind of interaction. It shouldn't be separate. I think others in Boston has done that much better than we. So there's that kind of ingenuity, which grows out of a vision, though, that the action has to develop local economies as well as a larger one, and that then rescues work for community, kind of good work. I can think of a recycling enterprise that began in a church parking lot, which has now grown to include lots of drop-off centers and an end-use plant that's actually using now plastic and rubber pellets and so on, and which not only gets all these alley entrepreneurs but many others along the way, and which the city is adopting to rescue its own problem of the loss of drop-off sites. Well, let us simply let you all go with this kind of thinking. And next week, we're going to when we read Genesis, we will strike one note that I think is important for this discussion that I hope you will just take along now and begin to think about, namely that of Sabbath. Biblical mentality says two things about work and about God. The ancient Hebrews took issue with the Babylonians, whose gods worked all the time. They were too worried, and they made people work all the time, sacrifices and whatnot. Later, when the dialogue partner was the Greeks, they objected to a god that rested all the time, like Herodotus and Lucretius's gods, you know, didn't do anything. For the Christian, you have work, and you have this wonderful notion of rest. And the important thing is that's not just resting up for more work. No, that's a rest that plays back over your work and has to do with how you look at things. You're working well when you treat animals and plants and materials as fellow creatures. How you look at other people. Remember we said the service economy is turning citizens into clients. Well, you pray with them or something and they're fellow citizens again. And also would have to do with production. You wouldn't just produce indefinitely. Talk about somehow a lot. Once again, technology in the root sense of a logos of techne. What kind of making enriches life and what doesn't. And then I think the other last note you would add to that kind of rest is Jesus' word. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest.